I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We are continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The theme today, what we might expect from a Hillary Clinton White House, but more importantly, a look behind the throne. Truth about America's aggression against Vladimir Putin in Russia. Who controls the presidents? Who controls most of the major policymakers in the United States? To share in these insights is Danny Sheehan, one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the 45 years he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, because without Danny's approval, there would have been no publication of the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Karen Silkwood murder case, and others. He has represented victims of so many of America's aggressions. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. Danny has his law degree from Harvard University. He was Harvard Law, and later returned to study at the Harvard Divinity School, where he also degreed. He's the author of The People's Advocate, The Life and Legal History of America's Most Fearless Public Defense Lawyer. His websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, that's SHEEHAN.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Well, thank you, Gary. I'm pleased to be here.
Danny, we have heard a lot about WikiLeaks. We have heard and seen through Julian Assange's many different WikiLeaks that what we are told is rarely the case when it comes to our political process. We now know that much of the media has been able to align itself with the Clinton campaign. We know that the Clinton campaign, working hand-in-hand with Schultz, who was former head of the Democratic group, that they undermine Bernie Sanders. Now, personally, I believe that Bernie Sanders should have stayed in the race and galvanized his enormous young millennial audience and went forward with his, at least on many domestic issues, not his foreign issues, but more progressive policies such as reining in the big banks, free student tuition in public schools, etc. But that wasn't to be the case. He stepped aside real quick and immediately got behind Hillary Clinton, though it still remains to be seen how many of his followers will support Clinton. When we hear about what Clinton believes in, all we have to do is take an honest, objective look at what she has achieved when she and her husband, Bill Clinton, were in effect co-presidents. You can't have it both ways. She was not like Mimi Eisenhower. She wasn't like Pat Nixon. She was a part of all the policy making, and she had enormous influence, according to people who worked in the White House. So she can't say that she was a part of these major decisions, but oh no, that's not my responsibility if it went wrong. Today, we have to take a look back to see what is the likely outcome going forward. But something bothers me, something no one in the media, not the mainstream media, nor the alternative media, has explored. What if it doesn't stop with Hillary Clinton? What if there's a group of individuals so powerful, so influential, so interconnected, that this cabal is able to influence her decisions, Obama's decisions, Bush's decisions, and the original Clinton White House decisions? And the person who would know about this is you. So before we talk about NATO and what it's doing in Russia, against Russia, and before we talk about the Middle East and Syria and why we're only hearing one side of the story, before we talk about Clinton's participation in the coup in Russia or towards Russia, we're going to talk about who controls Bill and Hillary Clinton. You have been, through 45 years, in the middle of all this. So please tell us from the best observations, names, people, organization, who are the real powers behind the scenes? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, it's as you know, Gary, the various litigations that I've been involved in, where we actually have full-time professional investigators in the field using their sources to dig out information, had been directed primarily during the period after I got out of Harvard Law School in 1970, all through that period of time, focusing on the group that we eventually surfaced as the Enterprise, that came to public knowledge during the Reagan-Bush administration, and that we did the full-scale investigation that determined that this group of people had been put together during the period before and after the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, and that what we discovered is that in the very aftermath of World War II, the people that were in a particular private investment firm known as Brown Brothers Harriman that was put together back in the period during the robber baron era between 1868 and 1898, that entire robber baron period where the owners of major steel companies, iron smelters, railroad companies, oil companies, agricultural companies, what they did is they systematically placed on the courts in the federal court system, leading all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, their corporate lawyers. And their corporate lawyers entered a series of rulings that ended up asserting that there was a new model of business that was the shareholder-owned corporation in which the men, virtually uniformly men, the men who owned the resources of a particular company could in fact incorporate that company and have the company own the resources and the men own the stock that represented the ownership of the company. But they were thereafter immunized legally against any type of legal claims that would be filed against the corporation itself. And the management of the corporation were legally immunized against any legal liability for anything that the corporation did. And the board of directors of the corporation were legally immunized against any kind of liability for anything the corporation did. And they even went so far as eventually designating that corporation as a person that was actually entitled completely independently of those men to enter into contracts, to make decisions about pumping their poisonous effluents from their corporations into the rivers and streams, pumping effluents into the atmosphere, poisoning the atmosphere, et cetera. Also creating products that were dangerous to the users, so that the people who were injured by their products or the people that were injured in the manufacture of their products had no legal cause of action whatsoever against those who actually owned the resources of the company or those who made the decisions, whether they were on the board of directors of the company or the management, that just the entity itself, the person of the corporation, was liable. And then what they did, of course, is they hired a battery of lawyers who figured out how to keep the income that was coming into that corporation from their various policies and conduct, that it would transfer immediately to the stockholders who would own it privately, or the money would be held in separate accounts of different subdivisions that were not part of that corporation, so that in case that corporation were sued by anyone who was injured by its activities, had a very limited pot of money against which to go. And this mechanism became so valuable to this group of robber barons that they became more and more wealthy. They joined together to form interlocking directorates. They sat on the boards of directors of each other's companies, like E.H. Harriman in the railroad lines, Carnegie with his steel companies, J.P. Morgan with his banking interests, David Rockefeller with his oil and petroleum industry, John D. Rockefeller with the oil that they, the corporations that they had. They sat on each other's boards of directors, but very importantly, they all sat together as private investment clients in a private investment company called Brown Brothers Harriman. And the CEO or chief executive officer for that particular coalition of robber barons was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker. And George Herbert Walker was the CEO of that private investment firm, Brown Brothers Harriman. And the lawyer for that private investment firm was Alan Dulles. He was a senior partner in the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell in New York City. This was a cabal of rich and powerful white multi-millionaire robber barons. And they, from that vantage point, took control over the entire American government so that by in a short 30-year period between 1868 at the end of the American Civil War up into 1898, with the 1896 election of William McKinley, that 30-year period marked an extraordinarily important time period in American history where these people rose up to the point where they began to exercise control over the policies of the United States government. That they directly paid for the campaigns of members of the United States Senate in the House of Representatives. They bribed the people in the Congress and in the executive administrations to appoint their lawyers to the Supreme Court. They basically utilized all of the instrumentalities of the United States government as tools by means of which they would promote and foster their business interests. And they would send, for example, they would send United States military expeditionary forces, you know, into countries such as Nicaragua or Panama or other places around the world, the Dominican Republic, and they would overthrow governments in those areas in order to get access to the natural resources that would then be provided to those corporations, which they would put through their capital equipment and generate profits for these men. And that operation was in full swing by 1898. And what happened in the United States is their activities gave rise to a counterforce in the United States that was actually put together by the National Board of Homeland Ministries of the United Methodist Church. And in 1872, they began to put together a set of meetings up in Chautauqua, New York, which was a summer resort that was owned by the Methodist Church, a summer camp. And they would bring in all of the potential new Sunday school teachers for the Methodist Church around the United States to bring them together to train them on how to teach about basic Judeo-Christian social ethical values and how much contrary to those values was the conduct of these major robber barons. And they began a thing that ended up being called the Chautauqua Movement. And it was the Chautauqua Movement that gave rise to the women's suffrage movement that eventually established by 1919 the right of women to vote in the United States. It established the American Union, labor union movement. It established the right of free public education for children. It established the original civil rights movement, the post-Civil War civil rights movement. It actually generated the anti-child labor laws around the country and the original conservation, setting up public parks, et cetera. Now, this is what generated the basic schism that took place in the Republican Party between McKinley and his vice president. Because when McKinley was assassinated, his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, rose to power, and Teddy Roosevelt began to try to rein in these powerful forces and began to try to bust up their monopolies that they established, because these companies became so powerful as they made more and more money, they would use the profits that they made to buy out and to bury any of their competitors, to the point where they ended up having virtual monopoly control over entire areas of the American economy. Now, this is a very important period of our history, because this is what led all the way up to the beginning of World War One in 1914. And as we remember, the United States didn't enter the war until later in the war. And by that time, the people in Russia had risen up, and the war that was going on in Europe, among all the European countries, Germany had invaded all these other countries, and it was in the war with Russia. And Russia, the people in Russia rose up and overthrew Tsar Nicholas and withdrew from World War One. And what happened is the United States came in and ended up coming into the war, and this group of people that were the robber barons that controlled everything ended up still controlling the American government. And this is the period which, of course, in 99, of course, virtually everybody who's listening to this out there, this is all just past history to all of us. But I ended up having to find out more about this in the direct context of doing major legal investigations and litigations, because what I discovered was that these people had devised this entire mechanism of having these military expeditions be mounted by the United States government around the world, but that after World War One, the entire world started being divided up among the nation states that had prevailed in the end of World War One, and these people did, for example, in 1922, at the end of the war, there was a commission that was established by the Western powers under the leadership of then the Secretary for the United Kingdom, for England, for the Secretary of Colonial Affairs, Winston Churchill. And he set up a commission, 22 people on the commission, and they simply superimposed upon the entire Middle East that had been the Turkish Empire, who were allies with Germany, that when they lost, the Western, when the Turkish and the Germans lost, the Western powers set up this commission to superimpose boundaries all throughout the Middle East, creating countries like Saudi Arabia, Libya, Syria. They set up all of these arbitrary boundaries so as to establish protectorates throughout that area, which really meant that those given countries that were in charge of that area as a protectorate could get the benefits of the oil that was in that territory. And so this unjust set of structures that were set up for the business interests at the end of World War One to simply expropriate the oil in that entire area, what they did is that commission designated in each one of those little arbitrary nation-state areas that had been superimposed upon an area where for 1,000 years there had just been tribal communities. This commission superimposed completely artificial nation-state boundaries, and they handpicked one family to be a royal family, to basically try to superimpose the kind of medieval European model of royalty in that area. And they designated one family, for example, in Saudi Arabia, a man by the name of Abdul Aziz, who became the patriarch of the House of Saud. They appointed the Kuwaiti royal family in an area they designated as Kuwait. They designated the Shah of Iran, the Pahlavi family, in an area they designated as Iran. But all of these areas were set up to basically foster and promote the private business interests of these people. And now that is something that there are footnotes to people's high school history books, and even in some of their college history books, saying, oh, yes, that was the robber baron era. That was the era when manifest destiny was implemented by the American government to lay claim to all of the territory in North America, to wipe out basically the Native American population and seize their property and all of their resources. And it was also the age of the white man's burden, in the age of imperialism, of gunboat diplomacy. We all hear about that in passing, but what it meant that was just immediately prior to by the end of World War I in 1917, that was the guiding ethic, the ethos of Western civilization, that these robber barons, these multimillionaire white businessmen and their financiers and bankers like J.P. Morgan and David Rockefeller and all of those, they basically were calling the tune, and they were in charge of controlling virtually all U.S. Policy in Western civilization. And the bottom line is that is the group that was like a governing cabal in Western civilization. And
yes. Could you bring us up to date? Because I have so many more questions to deal with now. I want to know, how do we go from this cabal and establishing the overarching business model and how it would influence all governmental policy, domestic and foreign, to the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas and the people today? Bring us up today so we can see what parts of this historical manifest are in play today?
One of the major organizational institutions that was established by these people was a group called the Council on Foreign Relations. It was set up by David Rockefeller, and he started recruiting all of these major businessmen to participate in this Council on Foreign Relations. And they were members of private clubs in New York. They would come together and meet. And what they would do is they would reach out and they would recruit people from the Republican and Democratic parties to come in to become part of the Council on Foreign Relations, where they would all sit together and craft policy that they would all come to an agreement on as to how it would promote and foster the interests of the major business corporations in the United States. And that the theory was that if the American business corporations did well, they could hire lots of people, they could produce lots of products, they could provide products to people in the United States, pay money to the people to manufacture them, and we would have a major, powerful and healthy economy. And that was the entire consensus that they had. And that what developed during that period, of course, now remember, what happened is that when the people rose up in the Soviet Union and established the Soviet Union, they identified that particular ethos, that white Caucasian nation-state alliance with the corporate capital corporations as the an imperial power in the world. And a basic dynamic began of the Soviet Union confronting this ethos in Western civilization. And the Western civilization then, rather than promote what they were doing as imperialism, white man's burden, or manifest destiny, they shifted into defining all of this as anti-communism. And what they did very quickly is they established, they actually funded directly through Brown Brothers Harriman and George Herbert Walker. They reached out and set up a thing called the Union Bank of New York. And the Union Bank of New York had capital money put into it by these private investors in Brown Brothers Harriman. And they set up a subsidiary bank in the Netherlands called the Bank of Commerce and Trade. And this bank actually financed the construction of the international headquarters of the Third Reich in Germany. And they financed the rise to power of Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich and the Germans. And they established they were going to be the bulwark against Bolshevism in Europe. And this whole operation went on of confronting the Soviets were confronting this imperialist, capitalist wedding between the instrumentalities of the states, the nation states, and the governing corporate elite in this cabal in Western civilization. This went on for 70 years. It went on all the way from 1917 all the way. There was a brief respite of this during World War II, and then at the very end of World War II, it continued again apace, now with the West mounting itself under the rubric of the Central Intelligence Agency, and that this whole operation was a quote, anti-communist operation, and it went on all the way until the key moment that we're talking about now, which is the voluntary dissolution of the Soviet Union on the night of December of 1991. This is the key historical fact that even this election that's coming up on November 8th is still just an echo of trying to readjust to this new situation in the world, with the Soviet Union having voluntarily stepped out of this competition against these people. Because what happened is right on in the week following the voluntary dissolution of the Soviet Union on December 31st of 1991, the administration in the United States at that time was under George Herbert Walker Bush. He was the grandson of George Herbert Walker, who was the CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman and the founder of the Union Bank of New York that actually financed the creation of the Third Reich, and that he was the president of the United States at this time. And what they did at that time is they tried to go back basically to the very period immediately before the formation of the Soviet Union as an antipodal force to this group, and tried to basically reestablish the same robber baron kind of white man's burden, manifest destiny concept. And they formulated, we've talked about it in previous shows, they formulated a United States Defense Department policy planning guidance document proposing that rather than cut back on military spending in the United States, commensurate with the end of the Cold War, which had been used for 70 years to rationalize an ever-increasingly larger and larger military budget, they said rather than cut back on the military budget, let's increase the military budget so that we can establish what they termed by their own words, full spectrum dominance over the planet. That was their objective. And they set it forth, and they were planning to do this, and they were planning to do this unilaterally on behalf of the United States. So the United States could basically stand astride the whole world, doing basically what Germany had offered to do or threatened to do back during World War II. And now the United States was proposing this secretly in a classified document that was drafted up by Dick Cheney, who was the Secretary of Defense for George Herbert Walker Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz, his Assistant Secretary of Defense, and David Addington, and Douglas Fife, and Elliot Abrams, a group of men. They put together this entire plan to have the United States be put into a position of global hegemony, military and economic hegemony over the world. Now, someone leaked a copy of this on March 18th of 1992 to the Washington Post. The Washington Post wrote a major editorial against it, followed by a major editorial by the New York Times against this in the third week of March of 1992. It embarrassed the George H.W. Bush administration because it was characterized by both newspapers as out-and-out gunboat diplomacy and a return to the age of the robber barons. Now, what happened is George H.W. Bush at that time apologized for that, saying, oh, it was just a draft. And what he did is he pulled back and he drafted a second version of this, a second version of the 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance document, in which he proposed doing this not unilaterally on the part of the United States, but very importantly for the discussion we're going to have today, doing it under the auspices of NATO, to actually have the NATO allies, the post-World War II NATO allies, combine together to establish this full-spectrum dominance over the planet so that they could, and this is the quote from the document, maintain the continued privileged access to the strategic raw materials needed by members of the new Northern Industrial Alliance. This was the so-called New World Order under the auspices of George H.W. Bush, and that the whole plan of this was to use NATO to provide the actual on-the-ground military forces in the United States pursuant to this document, the second draft of that policy document, which was called the Projection of U.S. Military Power into the 21st Century and Beyond. It was to be done through NATO, and the United States would provide all of the high-end military equipment, all of the air power, just air power. They wouldn't put the people on the ground. That would be done by the NATO allies. But they would do the air power. They would provide the F-14s and then F-15s, helicopter gunships, the missiles, everything else, everything that you see happening in Syria right now. And that what they would do is that other NATO allies had to provide the ground troops. And what they wanted to do is they wanted, and this becomes very important for our conversation today, what they wanted to do is they wanted to invite Russia to join into this new Northern Industrial Alliance now that Russia had spun off all of its ethnic provinces, which means the Islamic provinces and the Asian provinces, which really means it remaining just the Caucasian area of the former Soviet Union, now Russia. And now this was the New World Order that George H.W. Bush had in mind that he wanted to do. But what had happened is that the people who had drafted the initial draft, this is Richard Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and David Addington and Doug Fife and Elliot Abrams and those guys, they were much more reactionary, much more nativists. They wanted to have this done unilaterally on behalf of the United States. And so what happened is when George H.W. Bush lost the 1992 presidential election because Ross Perot entered the race as a third party with Bill Clinton representing the Democrats, George H.W. Bush representing the Republicans, and Ross Perot representing an independent candidacy, he won 19% of the vote. And then George H.W. Bush lost with only 38% of the vote, but Bill Clinton won the presidency in 1992 with only 43% of the popular vote. Basically, the approximate amount that you see right now, Donald Trump getting 38 to 42% of the vote right now. Now, this is not coincidental. When people look at the polls and say, oh, look, he's got 38% of the popular vote, no, 42% of the popular vote, 43% of the popular vote. These are the figures, the same figures that determined the outcome of the election back in 1992. And what this did is it pushed back the second draft of George H.W. Bush, pushing it back into this desire to use NATO and all of these other Caucasian nations around the world in a big alliance to establish a military hegemony around the world to basically confront the potential rise of China. That's what the point of this whole thing was. That's why George H.W. Bush invaded the Middle Eastern oil fields. As soon as he realized that the Cold War was coming to an end, he invaded and occupied the Middle Eastern oil fields primarily to keep China from getting access to that oil. This was a huge strategic play that took place. But the problem was that when George H.W. Bush lost the 1992 election because of the intervention of Ross Perot, what happened is that his adversaries inside his own administration, who had proposed the initial draft of the 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance document, these people, under Richard Cheney, came out and accused H.W. Bush of having lost the 1992 election because he was too weak. So they came forward organizing a group called the Project for a New American Century. And they proposed a major, muscled-up U.S. military policy of unilateral assertion of power on the part of the United States, and that they laid in wait all during the two administrations of the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration, from 1992 to the year 2000. And they were going to come forward with the presidential candidate being Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida. And they were going to have Dick Cheney, the former Secretary of Defense for his father, be his vice president. But the problem was that Jeb Bush got caught, you know, having face-to-face meetings during the Iran-Contra scandal with major drug smugglers and weapons smugglers to the Contras. And photographs were taken of him going in and out of the private home of Ronald Joseph Martin Jr., the owner of the Tamiami gun shop in Miami that was providing illegal end-user certificates for the weapons being smuggled to the Contras. And the Iran-Contra scandal exposed all of that. So he was unable to be the candidate. So what they did is they reached out to George W. Bush, a person that one would never have expected to have been entitled to a post like that because of his lack of comparative competence to everybody else. But they held him up as a figurehead for the administration, and Richard Cheney basically served as the president of that administration. And they came in, and as we all know, through basic voter fraud down in Florida and in the state of Ohio, the rigging of the Diebold voting machines, long discussion about that. We know that Michael Connell, the man who actually set up those Diebold voting machines in Ohio, has already told us in detail about how that whole thing was done. They took over and came into power in the year 2000. And then they began to wage their previous theory of unilateral U.S. military power. And so that's what they began doing. But remember, during the entire Clinton administration, Bill Clinton administration, what Bill Clinton did, he adopted basically the foreign policy of George H.W. Bush, this more multilateral NATO-grounded alliance in the world that would basically project forward the advantages of all of the capitalist countries of the world, the Caucasian capitalist countries of the world in the West, moving in unison. And so that as soon as his two terms were up, back came the Project for a New American Century, unilateralists, these kind of nativists, more primitive, robber baron types, and they ascended to power. And they asserted throughout the entire two administrations of Richard Cheney, basically, they asserted their extraordinarily bizarre and primitive type of invasion of other countries, reinvaded the Middle Eastern oil fields, invaded Iraq, you know, mounted a huge war. They had a list of some seven major countries in the Middle East that they planned to overthrow and supplant the leadership of them so they could put them under more and more control of the United States. And this is the experience that we've just had, that whole period of time from the year 2000 all the way through to 2008 when Barack Obama was elected president. And so the problem is that the only two proposals that were in the field to basically be United States foreign policy once the Soviet Union voluntarily dissolved in December of 1991 were these two simple options. One, of complete unilateral U.S. military hegemony around the world under the rubric of Richard Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and these guys. And the only other option was this less aggressive NATO alliance of all the Caucasian Western powers trying to bring into the fold Russia. but it was the people in the Cheney group that didn't want Russia in. They wanted the United States. They didn't want him as, they didn't want Russia as one of our previous competitors to be involved in this. So what the problem is now is that Barack Obama, when he came into office in 2008, he had a very particular kind of style. He was the style, I'll tell you first what the style is, and I'll tell you how I know that his style is, look at, let's give a little bit of everything to everybody who are the players at the table. Let's give everybody a kind of a yes on part of what it is they want, and we'll establish a kind of a consensus, and then we can do it all in coordination. And so he kept trying to give in to the people, saying, look, here are some of these Cheney-type people. Let's not prosecute any of these people. Let's not prosecute Cheney. Let's not prosecute Bush. No matter how much lying they did in supporting the war, invading into Afghanistan and in Iraq, let's not prosecute them for torturing anybody. Let's not hold against them the fact that they lied blatantly. Let's not punish anybody in the whole banking and financial industry that tried to rape and pillage the entire economic system, you know, by setting up these mortgage the default credit swaps. Let's not prosecute any of those people. Let's bring them all on board. Let's establish an alliance where we're all working together. But the problem is that the Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, extreme right wing Project for a New American Century people just dug in their heels and said, absolutely not. You know, we're not going to do that more moderate thing that George H.W. Bush proposed and that Bill Clinton proposed and now Obama is proposing. We want a hardcore right-wing, reactionary, kind of robber baron set of values like we were successful in doing between 1868 and 1898. And so that has ended up being the sole dialogue going on.
Okay,
and,
Danny,
and
I need you.
That's the problem we've got.
Okay, Danny. I need some real short answers now.
Yep.
You've brought us up to date. Now we have an understanding. So tell us, who are the most important people behind Clinton who are giving her the marching orders of what she has to do? And from what I understand, the Wolfowitz going to endorse Hillary Clinton.
Yes, right.
Also Rumsfeld endorsing
yes,
Hillary
right.
Clinton. So with the exception of Cheney, almost all the neocons,
that's
all
right.
of the New World Order people,
yep.
They're all endorsing Clinton. They wouldn't endorse her, including the Fortune 500 companies, the heads of all the Wall Street firms, the head of the all of the pharmaceutical industry, the head of the energy cartels. Every one of them is endorsing Clinton, unless they knew that she would be a more understanding and hard-line radical right shift. Once she's in office, she can pivot and let go of all the Bernie Sanders believers and the Michael Moore people who believe that somehow she's going to be progressive. She's going to go radical right. She's going to give them the hard line that they want against Russia using NATO. Is that right or wrong?
No, that's what it is. What she's trying to do is she's trying to establish a new coalition that is further to the right from where Obama did it. Obama tried to establish a coalition of having kind of a set of merely conservative policies, and he was trying to bring on the reactionaries to tolerate that, but they wouldn't. They just stonewalled him, and he wasn't successful in being able to implement his basic conservative policy.
She
is going to become not only conservative, but partly reactionary to accommodate them.
Hillary Clinton is the female version of Dick Cheney.
Well, not exactly. No, she's a hybrid. She's sort of a hybrid between Dick Cheney and George H.W. Bush. And that very dialectic that went on in the first weeks of 1992 with those two competing versions of the U.S. military policy planning document.
We got it.
That's where the dynamic is.
We got it. Now,
she's straddling them.
Okay, we only have 11 minutes, so I want to get some important stuff in. So please give me short answers,
yep.
Danny.
Yep.
Give me the names of some of the organizations, institutions, think tanks, or individuals who have more power than she, even if she's president, and she will follow their dictates.
Well, you look to the executive committee members of the Council on Foreign Relations. with David Rockefeller and those people. That's going to be the key to this. And the fact of the matter is that she is going to be bringing in certain people. One of the major people that one wants to keep an eye on is this William Burns. William Burns was the ambassador to Russia from the W. Bush administration. And the fact is that there's some indication that she's talking about bringing him on to be the potential Secretary of Defense, you see. And so that what she's doing is she's going to start picking. She views herself as being sort of the Catherine the Great of the United States, that she's going to be able to take people from the military industrial complex, the banking facilities, the Council on Foreign Relations, et cetera. She believes that the progressives in the Democratic Party are going to be able to be placated simply by some domestic progressive policies. Okay? So that's what she's going to do.
Okay, I would add in the Business Roundtable. That is one of the most powerful, if not the single most powerful group that the American public is unaware of. You add the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and the Business Roundtable, you have the ruling elite in America. You have about around 800 people that virtually control the world from right there, and the average American knows none of those.
There's a smaller group than that, though. There's a smaller group than that, in that my opinion is, and nobody's ever heard of this, and I'm going to tell you what it is. There is a group called the Anderson Trust. The Anderson Trust is a trust that was set up by Brown Brothers Harriman back in 1945. And it had at that time $1.2 trillion put secretly into that trust by these people to covertly finance campaigns around the world, primarily of fascists. And this is the key. What she is getting ready to put in place is a fascist administration. By that I mean the wedding between the instrumentalities of the government and the private corporations and the banking corporations and business corporations. This is what fascism is. That there's various kinds of authoritarianism all the way from the left to the right, but fascism is a very specific economic theory of wedding together the interests of the corporations and the state itself. And that's where she's going. She's trying to make it sort of non-controversial. They put up someone on the this person like Donald Trump who has got all kinds of primitive kind of a nativist kind of instincts and racist and all these kinds of things, and they make him a caricature. They make him a caricature, and so all of the other people that are part of the real governing power structure comes rolling in behind her. She, in fact, is going to be the first absolutely clear Republican president. You know, Bill Clinton made a pass at that, but what they did is they set up a thing called the Democratic Leadership Conference or the Democratic Leadership Council. She was the chairperson of the policy committee of the Democratic Leadership Conference. It was set up by Richard Gebhardt at the end of the Cold War because the response of the Democrats to the reaction that was set up inside the Republican Party of setting up this split between the Project for a New American Century people, on the one hand, under Richard Cheney in Wolfowitz, and on the other hand, between George H.W. Bush and Colin Powell, that were into this new world order under the NATO, that what's happened in the Democratic Party is that there was this whole move to set up this new, more moderate Democratic Party under the Democratic Leadership Conference that said, look, why should we be trying to placate everybody with these policy programs of uniform health care for everybody and all these other domestic programs when we no longer have a threat of the Soviet Union and a socialist option? Why are we doing that? There's no need to do this. Let's move the entire Democratic Party over toward the very middle to the right of center of the political spectrum. And let's push the Republican Party over to the extreme right of the political spectrum and to the right wing. And what she's trying to do now is to establish a right, not only a right of center coalition, but a right of center to reactionary coalition probably if you have 100 degrees to the right and 100 degrees to the left of center on the political spectrum, she's like going from 33 degrees to the right of center over to almost 50 degrees to the right of center. She's not as far right as Cheney himself, and she's not as far. She's right where George H.W. Bush, Senior would have been. We're getting basically another administration of George H.W. Bush. That's what we're getting.
Okay, Danny, we have 5 minutes. I want you to focus exclusively upon Russia. You were just in Russia. Tell us
yes.
what we are getting wrong from American media on Russia.
What's happened here? What we're really seeing here is the element inside the administrations that don't want to include Russia into the new alliance. The new alliance is being called for by the new world order of George H.W. Bush would include Russia in. But because Hillary Clinton is attempting to placate those Project for a New American Century people, she is deciding that she's going to exclude Russia from the benefits of this type of alliance. And people like Samuel P. Huntington, in his work called The Clash of Civilizations, The Remaking of the World Order, wants to have Russia included in. Because they are really looking at the longer game of wanting to establish complete union inside Western culture to confront the rise of the new Asian empire under China. That's the far distant future, and they want to prepare for that. These more short-visioned people like Cheney and the others, who are more kind of nativist and jingoist, they want to promote the American interest. And so what they're doing is they're trying to exclude Russia. So they're supporting this whole program of surrounding the Soviet Union with anti-ballistic missile systems. And all of these, there's seven of the former republics of Russia have now been brought into NATO. And they're trying to get the Ukraine brought in so they can complete the closure of Russia. They wanted to have the Crimea remain inside the Ukraine so they could cut off Russia from its sole warm water port in Crimea. I mean, that's how transparent is what's going on here. And that's why Putin moved on and had a plebiscite taken inside Crimea. 96% of the people saying we want to stay with Russia. And so he's accomplished that. But they're still trying to get all the rest of the Ukraine now to become part of NATO.
Okay.
That's what they were
Danny,
trying to do.
Danny, I'm going to hold for next week the Progressive Commentary Hour a full hour on your trip to the Vatican, in that full hour on Russia. What you met with top people in Russia. I want
yes.
that for an hour by itself. My final question, you have 3 minutes answered.
Yep.
First, a statement. I believe with Hillary Clinton becoming the president that it is only a matter of 1 to 2 years before we see a conflict with Iran, principally started by Israel with the full backing and support of the United States. And I believe if that happens, then you're going to see China, Russia, Iran, many other countries, not use traditional warfare, but to use, and not nukes, because it would destroy both civilizations, but instead using cyber warfare. And I believe that that is the high probability that they would all of them hit our country with cyber warfare and Americans be totally unprepared for what happens when the electricity goes out. What do you see happening with if Hillary becomes a president concerning a conflict in the Middle East?
I believe that people are failing to grasp the importance of the insurrection of the Wahhabist fundamentalist Islamicists, the Muslim Brotherhood. I think that all of this huge chess game that they've been playing here between the people from the Project for a New American Century and the New World Order, they have miscalculated dramatically, and that the fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood is going to be waging a war of terrorism against them. And they've totally miscalculated this thing. And so I think that they're going to be terribly distracted, and this is part of what potentially brings Russia more into alliance with the United States, because they, too, are a foreign power, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox religious community, along with the West and its Roman Catholic thing, and that the fact is there's getting set to be a potential major clash between Christendom and, in fact, the Islamic order in the Middle East. And the United States and others have to dramatically accelerate their development of alternative energy sources in order to become completely independent of their dependence on oil out of the Middle East, because that's all that the Islamists want. They want them out of the Holy Land. And I think that they're going to successfully drive the United States and Russia both out of the Holy Land, that they don't want either one of them in Afghanistan or in Iran or Iraq. And Iran is going to rise to become the dominant power in the Middle East. And that's going to be the issue. And the question is whether or not they're going to tolerate the existence of Israel. I believe that they'll accept that. I think they're going to accept isolating Israel in the territory where they are, but that the rest of the Middle East is going to come under the hegemony of Iran, and basically you're going to have a reestablishment of the old Persian Empire in the Middle East.
I believe that you're absolutely correct, except I believe Israel, as long as it stays under the Likud and Netanyahu group, will preemptively attack Iran, and that will change the entire scenario, but that is to be seen.
I think the U.S. and Russia together are going to be able to prevail upon Israel not to do that, and they're going to require absolute commitments to the preservation and protection of Israel, which they'll get, because Iran is willing to give them that, I think, for in exchange for their dominance in the Middle East.
But keep in mind, it was shown recently that Israel and the United States worked together to create a malware that could cause Iran's centrifuges to explode. What America did not know, what the National Security Agency and CIA did not know, is that on its own, the Mossad and Israel's intelligence created a separate malware that would turn off all the electricity in Iran. They would not have done that unless they had planned to have no ability for Iran to counterattack if it brought in planes to do the bombing on it. So we have a different position on that.
But we'll discuss it.
Danny, I look forward to our next discussion next week on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Fantastic. Okay, I'll see you then, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program.